Welcome to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, Episode 5. Today on the show, I have Chris Corfist, sprint coach at Montini Catholic High School in Lombard, Illinois, and owner of Slow Guy Speed School. Today's episode is brought to you by Eccentric, makers of the K-Box. The K-Box is an inertial flywheel training platform in which a flywheel is connected to a platform athletes can stand on, and through use of a harness or a barbell connector or even a handle, can do a variety of athletic movements such as squatting, pressing, split squats, lateral squats, even arm curls. And I've had the K-Box for over a year now. I love using it. If I had to describe probably the biggest benefit in a nutshell, it would just be the simplicity of eccentric overloading. To get eccentric overloads using traditional barbell work, it can be done, but it's not easy. You need things like weight releasers, partners to take plates on and off, and a variety of means and methods that lifters have contrived over the years. The K-Box makes eccentric overloading, or the downforce associated with lifting, and more particularly sprinting and jumping, extremely simple and smooth to acquire, rather than being jerky or segmenting it. And I've really enjoyed that fact on how easy it is to get a big eccentric overload in my athletes. And this has applications to sprinting, jumping. I even use it with swimming in more of a high rep, just trying to get a biochemical response to the athlete type scheme. And it makes it convenient to do that too. So Chris and I talk about it in the episode a little bit, especially in the scope of the minimum effective dose. And if you're interested in learning more about the K-Box unit, head over to Eccentric. That is EXXENTRIC.com. On today's show, we have Chris Corfist. Chris has been a huge influence on me in my own coaching and development. And at first, I heard of Chris was through the old InnoSport website. And reading his articles, they just made a lot of sense to me. Chris's own experience, he is a high school sprint coach in Illinois, has had a ton of success, loads of all-state athletes, state champions. And he also works with and consults with professional athletes and is a renowned expert on speed training. Today on the episode, we're going to get into things like agility training and basically considerations for teams who are getting ready for their fall season, team sports, as well as how to approach the off season for track and field, and Chris's uses of things like the 1080 and K-Box in those related aspects. So also, if you want to get a hold of some of Chris's DVDs, which are, were out of print or out of production for a while, but he now has them available, would highly recommend them. You can go to his website, slowguyspeedschool.com, or just check the links on the associated article of this podcast. So with that said, here, let's get to the show. Okay, Chris, great to have you on the show, man. How are you doing today?
Well, thanks. It was 95 degrees earlier today. Now it's down to 70, so can't complain.
Yeah, absolutely. I have no idea what 95.
It's not that Phoenix heat, but
yeah. Oh yeah, seriously. Yeah, I have no idea what 95 feels like anymore. Just living in the Bay Area, but good training weather for sprints, right?
Yeah. We like it when it's hot.
Cool. So hey, let's jump in the first question here. And
sure.
Something I'd definitely like to pick your brain on, kind of lead off this podcast with. And I missed your presentation on it at the Speed Football Consortium 3, but I'd like to get your thoughts on building agility in athletes. A few questions, I guess. First, just in talk in terms of drills, just doing like basic agility drills versus bringing environmental things into the equation, a little bit more integrated and advanced. And, just like sprinting, what's the value of, the basic drills versus making things more lifelike?
Sure. I think the first thing about agility is kind of, I don't know if it's a pet peeve, but something I think that gets overdone are the agility ladders. If you break that down and look to see what's actually going on when people are going through there, and I'm sure there's great YouTube videos and someone's going to try and prove me wrong, but basically both feet are almost on the ground at the same time the whole time you're doing that drill. So you can do icky shuffle, you can do whatever fancy dance move you want through there. Your feet are almost on the ground at the same time. And in sport, if you have both feet almost on the ground at the same time, you're really not going anywhere. You're not getting a lot of force put down into the ground. There's no hip movement. It's just a very fancy, it's almost like a dance move type thing. And I'm sure there's some benefit in moving your feet quickly and knowing where your feet go. But half the time, people have dropped their head. They're into a bad postural position. And you've taken away people's vision because you're looking down. And that's really part of agility, is recognizing what's going on and getting there by that reaction time from your visual field to your brain to your feet. And so that's that. I got to go work with an NFL team earlier in the spring, and their complaint was everyone wants to be a defensive back coach. Why? Because you can get your kids to run through those ladders and you can make them look really quick and fast. But I don't know how great they are. So I don't do those. I haven't done them in quite a while.
Yeah, perception of speed versus actual speed. Yeah, definitely.
It's a big difference. Big difference. So drills that I do like, I like to add some kind of recognition or visual cue into any of the agility drills that we do. So I might put cones of different colors out and just yell out a color, and you've got to get to that cone. So whether you're facing the wrong way or whatever position I put you in, or whatever stance that you start in, you have to make, you have to recognize that color and get to that color. And then we can add in whatever, karaoke or shuffle or whatever into that as well. But I think that with agility drills, there needs to be some kind of recognition or a reaction to what you see. Because in sport, you react to what you see. Especially in team sports, whether it's football, basketball, you've got to recognize that something's going on and you've got to learn to get there. One thing that I've kind of phased out, or I'm going to phase out, is all the lateral movement where you're going to do a shuffle for 5 yards or a karaoke for 5 yards. I don't think that happens in sport. You may take one shuffle step, but then you're turning and running. And that's something that I really want to try and put in more of, is that you make that one shuffle step or that one step in a different way, but then accelerating out of that spot, out of that position.
Great.
So drills that I use, you can put cones anywhere and make them get to a cone, however they're going to. I like putting people in positions where they're off balance, because normally in a game you're not perfectly in a perfect square stance or a staggered stance and get to go from that. You've got to find balance and then go. And I think that's more of an environmental specificity type situation where you don't get this perfect release every time from whatever position that you're in. One thing that I've started doing, and again, I have good technology. I've been lucky enough to have people send me stuff, and I pay for it. So I'm lucky enough to have a wife that lets me buy stupid stuff or good stuff too. It's called a Speedlight. It's an Australian company. It's a timer. It does phenomenal things. And there's lights on the top of the timer, and you can set them to go off in whatever mode you want, but you put someone in the center, or you can array the lights wherever you want, and they have to react to the light changing. And so the light will flash and you've got to go get to that light, and you stick your hand through the beam, you can stick your foot through the beam, you can set up the beam so it picks up in a lot of different ways, and then you got to get back to wherever you're starting from. And this machine can measure reaction time, it measures your speed to the light. You can arrange it so you go from different light to different light, or come back to a cone and then go back to the light. So I think that's what's made me see agility in a different way, is the reaction and how fast you can react to that reaction and get to that light and come back. Because once you put numbers on things, people go harder. I think we all know that. I think that's a given at this point.
Yeah.
Whether you're fly timing or accelerations or whatever.
Yeah, it seems like in the world of track and field, measuring is everything, but it's like now starting to trickle down into agility a little bit too.
Yeah, and that's what's cool, is now we can see how quick people really are. You might have the fancy footwork through the ladder, but now let's see. Can you get to that light and turn that light off and come back?
Yeah, measurement and the technology seems like, obviously it's helped with just sprint, timing, but agility, I think there's a lot more application. I just saw the basketball strength coach where I work. He was showing me something similar. It's like there's an iPad in front of you and you're on a dot drill mat, and that if it flashes to the corresponding point, you have to make that movement. Although obviously more speed ladder-esque in nature, more than open chain environment, where what you're talking about I like the speed ladder analogy. It's almost like, yeah, the only time you'd have your feet together is if you're like a human bowling pin, and someone's rolling a big ball at you and you're ready to fall over. I that was a great point. I had never really thought of it that way before. If you so based on some of these things you're talking about, Chris, if you had to kind of give like a really basic progression, maybe the football coach who's getting ready for the fall, or just I guess obviously you get some great points already. Just basically take the drills you do, but assign colors and assign a more an open chain. But what's one thing most coaches could do now to take their agility work from what you've seen and really to kind of take it to the next level?
But one thing that I picked up in this last year was that first step and how your hips move on that first step. Franz Bosch's new book, Strength, the other book was Running. This one's, I think, is Strength Training. Great book. I think it's probably the best thing out there, in my opinion. Is that how your hips work on that first step? And I forgot what the term is that he uses, but it's basically you're trying to ratchet that hip. So when you go to drive, whether you're cross-stepping, crossing over, or straight on, that hip has to come up and forward. And what happens when you do that is it creates actually more time for your foot to come underneath your center of mass instead of out in front of your center of mass, and it gets you much better extension off whatever position that you're in. He calls it lock position of the hip and swing leg retraction. And so basically, like I said before, the closer your both feet are to the ground, the less distance you're going. This is ensuring that you're creating as much, you're getting one leg off the ground much higher than you would normally. I think one cue that Jimmy Radcliffe had when he was speaking at the consortium last week was how much separation are you creating between your knees? And that was one thing, that was one cue that I really hit home with me, something that I hadn't used before, but then it made sense. And so when you're braking or cutting or even accelerating, I think that's a great cue is how much separation can you get between your knees? And if you jack your hip up, you push that hip high and try and, I call it ratcheting up, you're creating even more space between your knees, which is awesome because, okay, great, I can go laterally, I can do a crossover and use these moves, I can come out of a cut that way, but it's also a great way just to start accelerations and to train accelerating. So it's cool because you're doing agility work and acceleration work all at the same time. And so when you're a strength coach, and especially now in the summertime where you have 45 minutes to be with someone, or a half hour, or 20 minutes, that's a great way to get a lot done with one drill.
Awesome. Yeah, I love it. When you were mentioning that, I was thinking about acceleration as well, and it's kind of the same world, and it's something that athletes are already familiar with if they've been coached with basic speed. So it's just the continuation of that.
Yeah. And unfortunately, in football and basketball, everything but track, nothing's straight ahead. Everything's got some kind of movement to it other than a straight line, which
Yeah,
is the beauty of track and field.
Yeah, it's everything else is so complex, and that first step is so huge too. If you, I mean, if you miss that in track, you're certainly disadvantaged. Something you talked about at, I think, the speed football too, the velocity, the exit velocity out of the blocks being so huge.
Yeah, that was, and I think that's still huge. How fast can you get moving before your first step hits the ground?
Yeah, I think that's.
You
Oh, sorry.
just get a lot more momentum that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, momentum is a critical factor. Even the strength coaches, they'll admit that, that what they're doing isn't really that helpful beyond a certain, a certain distance out. But yet still, if you can be more powerful and have more momentum in that first little bit.
And then there's that research going out, and I forgot where I saw it, but adding weight to your body when you jump does not help your vertical jump.
Interesting. Is that and acute or chronic?
What's that?
Is that a short or long term, or what's the length of that?
I forgot. I just caught a bit. You know, I saw the abstract, and I don't think I paid the $19.95 to get the whole thing or whatever that was. But I don't know. It might be. Maybe I saw it on J.B. Morin's ResearchGate thing. And I know when I saw him in Norway, he mentioned something like that as well. Because I asked him about that research, and he said, you know, well, he didn't have a very thorough answer, but he goes, you know, you got to look at your force velocity curve and see where they're missing in that force velocity curve to really pinpoint how you're going to improve that first step. As you, what'd you call it, the exit?
Exit velocity.
Exit velocity, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I like that, exit velocity.
Yeah, the new term. Here we go.
New term.
Yeah, that maybe it suddenly has resonates with some athletes here. They're out of the blocks. Cool. So along those the lines of, you know, initial strength too, you know, it's the summertime. A lot of coaches are getting their athletes ready for fall sports, and there might be, you know, track and field athletes who are just trying to do something else in the summer, doing strength training or things like that. And I've personally learned a lot myself just through, you know, some of your articles in the past, and the first one that really changed my paradigm on lifting and the fact that skills in lifting could spill over to the track was, you know, I forget the name of the article, but it was basically, you know, if you squat too much, you're going to start running like you squat, and you're going to lack hip and extension and plantar flexion and all those things, and I think sometimes it's helpful, you know, you see a coach who says something, but I think a lot of us realize that us coaches had to make a lot of mistakes with lifting to get where we were. And I guess I'd like to start this out by kind of your story with strength training over the years. You know, what are things you did as an athlete? What are you things you did with your athletes? And how has that landed you with the place you are now with your approach to speed?
Well, I was overcome by the weightlifting thing. I think I went to a football camp. I knew I went to a football camp at University of Illinois. And the strength coach came out, and this was, God, early 80s, before that was like an actual position or a big position. And the guy said, the more you squat, the faster you can run. And here's our proof. This guy's name was Mitchell Brookins. And I don't think he was a good player at Illinois, but I don't think he played in the NFL. But he was fast. He was our first 4.440. And this is just when they're starting to time 40s. You know, I think they're just coming out of the 100-meter dash time and realizing that's way too long to have any impact in football. But then he sold this poster, and it said Illinois weightlifting for football. And it was just a normal old-fashioned poster size. And it had all the lifts that you needed to do in order to be a football player. And of course, first one right across the top, king of the squats or king of exercises, the squat. And it showed you how to picture how to do it. And you know, you do 3 sets of 10 and whatever. So for the longest time, I was the squat guy. I could squat a lot of weight, but it never really had the impact that it should have if I followed this coach's, you know, philosophy. And, you know, when I was growing up in the 80s and early 90s, weightlifting was really starting to take off. And, you know, I tried everything. There was this old company called Speed City, and you got this catalog. Remember, there's no computers yet. So
yeah, this is the ancient era. A lot of athletes aren't used to this. And coaches aren't used to this era.
Yeah, you got a catalog, and you could order all kinds of stuff, you know, overspeed, bungee cords, old Vertimax type stuff, and every Christmas that's what I'd ask for, is some speed thing. But I stuck pretty hardcore to the weightlifting stuff for quite some time. I've been out to Westside Barbell a couple times and spent, you know, what it would end up being over a week there. You know, if you put together all my time that I spent there. And early in my career, I had my kids squatting hard. We had reverse hypers and glute hams. And, you know, I think that the important thing is that you learn, and you have to be brave enough to get rid of what doesn't work and look at your data in a hardcore fashion and not be married to any movement or anything. I mean, I went through that this year with a Sprint 1080. We're measuring our kids every 3-4 weeks, and we hit a period there where we got worse. And I, you know, I've wanted to say, well, you know, how could it be me? This has worked forever. You know, this is my tried and true way. But I had to say, you know what, it's, here's the data, it's not working. I need to change what I'm doing. And so you can't, I don't think you can get married to any exercise or anything. You just have to keep searching. And then every individual is different, and you've got to find what works for that individual. So long story short, I got to a point where I kept asking Louis questions, and he said, you know what, maybe you need to talk to someone else. And, you know, I went through a variety of gurus. You know, I worked with John Davies for a while. And, you know, you grab what you can from the different people that you learn from, and you keep what's good, and maybe you modify it a little bit so it works for you. But, yeah, you've seen the side of my house, all the equipment that I don't use anymore that's sitting on the side of my house that my wife yells at me, when are you going to throw it out? And I said, oh, you know, I might morph this into something else if I can find someone to weld and change this piece here. So, yeah, you got to keep moving and keep learning and not be married to anything, because you never know. And I'm amazed that when I go back and I read books that I read 5-10 years ago, and you pick up new things because you have a whole new layer of knowledge, or at least I hope that you would, over those years, and all of a sudden things look different when you look at them a second time. You know, that happened to me with Carmelo Bosco when I got his manual and I read through it, and I thought I got it, but then I was cleaning out a drawer and I found it again. Because I had one of the original manuscripts, so it had no cover. It was literally just pages of poorly translated Italian. And I went through it again. I said, my God, this is genius. Well, how did I miss this last time? Well, I just didn't have the knowledge base to get it the first time I read through it, or the second time I read through it. So, you know, sometimes it's great to go back and look at what you did before and see what really worked and bring it back. And, you know, I do that all the time. You know, I'll go through something and I'll see some kid run. I'll go, you know, why did I get rid of that exercise? Why did I stop doing that? I'm doing that with Captain Morgans now, where I used to use that a lot, and for some reason I just stopped using it. Captain Morgans is kind of a hip run where you take one leg out and you literally look like Captain Morgan, and you jump down the track. And it worked really well. And then for some reason I stopped. And I think this summer I thought, maybe I got to go back to that. That worked really well. I don't know why I got rid of it. So I don't know if that answers your question.
That's a good answer. I, you know, especially like, I think the anecdotes almost always start with us too, you know, coaches, and we were athletes who tried everything, and, you know, we hit that block. And then, but I agree. There's a lot of stuff I look back to some of my programs I did when I was even, you know, 25, and there was stuff that worked. I didn't know why it worked.
Yeah.
And now I'm reading, like, you know, all this, you know, Franz Bosch stuff, strength training coordination. I went back to the D.B. Hammer book. I read that this past year again. I hadn't read it in like 8 years, and I was like,
it's a good book.
Yeah, it was amazing. And, you know, just look at like the brackets of work and like all these like light bulbs go off. But 8 years ago, I had no idea. I mean, I just never even made it through the book. And
I wish I had a copy of that again. I lost mine, and I don't think they make them anymore.
No, it's a rarity.
he's a real dude. That was a real guy.
Yeah, everyone was always mysterious. Everyone was like, "Who is he? Like, where did he come from?" So
Dan Fichter had an interesting run-in with someone in Rochester, and he ran into someone who was from Germany and actually trained with him, Dietrich Buchenholz. And he's a real guy, and he had really good ideas. It's just, I think he got tired of, you know, all the emails and all the controversy and all the stuff. And he said, you know what, I don't need the internet. I got plenty of business coming in my door. I don't need all this stuff. And he went silent, and has been since however many years ago that was.
Yeah,
12 years.
I wonder what he's been thinking all this time with all the people talking about his system. I guess maybe you can do that after you've kind of learned so much and worked with so many people.
Yeah.
Bringing this back a little bit to the lifting and coaching world, and maybe some things. A question I had hoped to ask you was, you know, based on everywhere you've been, you know, with strength training and you know, basically relentless tinkering might be a good word. I think Dan Fichter, I think, might have used that a little bit too, that ideal. But if you could give, like, if you were stuck and you could only use two strength training exercises to build, you know, 100, 200 meter sprinter speed, you know, what would you pick? In your basement gym, which is amazing, and I think that any coach should try to find their way there at some point. What are two exercises that you, if your wife, you know, said you have to throw out all these machines except for two, what are two that you would say, I'm hanging on to these?
I am keeping, so anything in my basement.
Yeah, anything, all the stuff, all the it's a sad day, but all the machines, if you had to use two of them. Or
can I have three?
Yeah, I'll give you three.
Okay. I'm keeping my hammer strength deadlift machine because that's where I do all of my isometric work. And even with like a safety squat bar, I still like that machine better. I'm keeping my K-Box. And I don't care if it's the old model or the new model. They're both good to me. And that way I can do, you know, some really good eccentric work and some good concentric work as well. I don't do a lot of exercises on either machine, but I don't think you need a lot of exercises. And then I'm going to keep my four-way hip. I really like that machine. I do it side to side, so you're working your glute med, and I do it facing into it, so you're doing a toe-off exercise with your knee up, and I think that works your reflex, the reflex of running, you know, your stumble reflex really well, and it forces athletes to get to their big toe in a safe fashion. And if I want to make it crazy, I'll put something unstable underneath their foot, but that's hard to get to. So I need three. I would need three.
Understandable.
And if I had to get rid of one of those, I think I'd get... I can do without the four-way hip, so I'm keeping the K-Box and hammer strength deadlift.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. The four-way hip machine is, I guess, as I've grown as a coach myself, you know, I think when you're starting as a young strength and conditioning coach, it's almost like we go through these stages of awareness, you know, originally. It's like, okay, you know, whatever you do in the big lifts is the biggest transfer, and the fastest people are really strong, so obviously, you know, it's linked, but over my time as a coach and then just learning more about the reflex action, you know, the reflexive nature of strength and how important those hip flexors are, I think that's something a lot of coaches miss. And
yeah, I think four-way hip machine gets a bad rap because that's what all the ladies use at the gym to get rid of, you know, their thighs touching or something in their hips that they don't want, and they do it wrong. The hip that's doing the movement is always burning on them, and it should be the hip of the leg that's on the ground. I think that machine has got a bad rap, and that's how I get mine. Is I go on eBay and I find all the places that are dumping them for $75. I'll pay the $300 in shipping, and then I'll get it and I'll beat the hell out of it till it breaks, and I just get another one.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, the stigma of the machines. And you know, if someone can use it and be on their cell phone, it's probably something we would never associate with athletic performance. But you know, that makes sense too. Like you know, you were saying, the foot that's on the ground, like kind of being on the ball of the foot or using different positions there, or the plant foot to drive drive off of.
I think that's huge. And if you get someone on there that's, you know, not very good at running, they can't bring that knee up, they can't extend through that leg. And when you get good extension, you end up in a perfect position where that knee's not too far out back, where you're using your quads to drive. And it's actually a great butt exercise when you're pushing that thing up.
Yeah. Yeah, you probably would feel it more through the glute if you're actually, you know, connecting the ankle into it.
Yeah, and it's pure vertical force. I mean, you are pushing up into that arm when you're coming up.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, great exercise and machine, and I think, yeah, there's so many applications, and it's one that, yeah, I think definitely with the modern strength coach community and a lot of the, you know, the the very general strength mentality, it's definitely something that most people wouldn't ever look to really use, you know, and it doesn't something that gets the, you know, the big force or bang for the buck tag to it that often.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, and that's the problem, is everyone's looking for the magic bullet, and I've been looking one for 25 years, and they don't exist.
Yeah, no, tell me about it. I'm still searching, and I'm sure I'll probably be at that place eventually. keep getting my hopes up. So, being the summer, I guess, you know, like track athletes, for example, you know, a lot of them are probably doing sports, but what do you kind of tell your, I mean, I imagine a lot of your track and field athletes are playing sports throughout the year, but what do you tend to, how do you tend to approach strength training for track athletes in the off season? Like, you know, summer through the fall and things like that.
We do speed.
There's your strength, right?
Yeah. I mean, think about it. I mean, sprinting's 4 times your body weight or 5 times or something like that. So being in Chicago, we do, if I have 2 days to work, one day we will do a fly of some sort, probably 10 meters, because to me that works. And then we're going to do an acceleration day, and we're going to keep doing that until the weather turns crappy. You can build on your flies and your accelerations by adding other exercises and doing different things, but those are the base of what I want to improve on. And because once it gets crappier, you know, you're from Wisconsin, you're done.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of space to go run, and then all right, now I need to do some isometric work, I need to do some other stuff, because I've lost all my space. So our sport is sprinting, and that's what we do, is we sprint. And like I said, I'll build onto that, and we'll do some K-box stuff, but you know, I've got the 1080 sprint, so I can always do acceleration work, and I can always do overspeed work, which you build to. I'm not going to take some young kid and drag him at 10.3 meters per second down the street. But you know, my athletes that have been around a little bit, we're either overspeeding or accelerating. Daphne Schippers, you know, Netherlands.
Yeah.
That's what her workout is right now. She's either doing acceleration work on the 1080, or she's getting dragged, doing overspeed stuff.
Yeah, the overspeed on the 1080 too. I mean, you've obviously gone through all modes of overspeed and resisted throughout your time as a sprint coach, and I would like to ask you a little bit about, you know, I mean, you seem to always be on the cutting edge in terms of, if there's something new like a 1080 or the K box, you tend to have it before most. So I guess a twofold question. First, how is like the resisted and assisted on the 1080? How have you been able to use that in a kind of a different way compared to some of the traditional ways people do overspeed? And then what are some of the things that you've learned from the technology you've used, like, you know, K-Box, GymAware, and those types of things with your athletes?
So first part of the question, 1080 is different in that if I know what your fly 10 time is, and I know how many meters per second you're covering, I know exactly where I can dial you in for overspeed work, and which is supposed to be 3 to 5% over your maximum velocity. So let's say I have a kid that goes 10 meters per second, which is, you know, that's a decent time. With this machine, I can walk him off 100 meters away, and you know, I can program in when I want this cord to start picking them up and dragging them at 10.3 meters per second, and it's exactly that speed. It's kind of cool in the fact that people are flying and you don't see any braking, because I'll go film them. It's a really easy machine to work, so I go film and I see if there's braking going on, and you know, if you go too fast, yeah, you're gonna brake. But that's where I learned, yeah, that 3 to 5% rule, which somehow they came up with 20 years ago, that really applies. If you go faster than that, kids will come back and say, yeah, coach, I felt my heels hitting, it's too fast. And so it's interesting, in when you hit it right, the nervous system responds in a funny way. The first time I did it, I had three really good athletes, Big Ten professional athletes. We had I have a 1080 group that meets on at 6 o'clock in the evenings, and that's all we do is 1080. That way I drag it out onto my street once a day, and I know there's no cars coming by. And the first time I dragged them and I got the speed right, they got sick.
Huh.
And they said, Coach, we're in great shape, but their nervous system kind of went into this shock, like, oh my God, what's going on here? And one kid threw up, the other two didn't feel so great. But what was cooler is when they came back 3 days later, they ran and jumped better than they ever had before. And so that was a time when I had the right exercise at the right time. The temperature was perfect. It was about 90 degrees, and it just hit. And you could see the immediate response in the next workout. So if that's one thing I've learned, is if you hit it right and you have guessed right for whatever the workout is, you see immediate responses. And the next time they come back, and they are noticeably better. Another thing I've learned with Gym Aware, K-Box, Sprint 1080, is that you don't need to do much to make a change. And if you're really watching numbers, whether it's Gym Aware on your, you know, moving the bar fast, or K-Box and reading your K-Box meter, 1080, and you're reading power outputs, kids get tired pretty quick. 2 to 3 reps, and usually they're done. And then you see big drops in numbers when then you're starting to recruit other muscles, you're fatigued. And so I've learned to really cut back on what we do. And again, like I said, when I went down with the NFL team in the spring, they're a big what's the computer thing? Cal's going to kill me because I don't know this. Catapult. And they're measuring people, you know, how many steps you're taking, how many routes you're running. They cut way back on what they were doing because the numbers came back and said, you're running these guys into the ground. No wonder why people are getting hurt. And so they've cut back on what they do as well. In fact, they brought in more wide receivers and more defensive backs, so the quarterback could get more, as many reps. But now we've got more people running routes and doing the skill guy stuff, just to cut down on how much they're running. So I think when you say 10 sets of 100 meter dash and stuff like that, or even like my daughter plays high school basketball and I watch their running, it's way too much. And you're training kids to be slow. You're training kids to run inefficiently. And even though you have with all your heart and best interest for these guys, and you think we need to get in better shape, which is what every coach says when they start up the season, is we're not in very good shape. We got to get in better shape. No, they're already in shape. Why do you have to be able to run a gazillion gassers when really in basketball it's an anaerobic sport? You know, why do we have to be in this great aerobic shape all the time? You don't. I don't think you do. And so that's one thing I've learned, is to cut back, that sometimes less is better. And again, you're just trying to make a change. You're trying to make a neural change so the body responds and comes back and does it a little bit better the next time.
Yeah. So you basically find, and this is something I've been learning, especially the last year, and on, I guess, two fronts, is the idea of the minimum effective dose. And I think that's starting to make its way around the strength and conditioning community too, with, you know, coaches who are scaling back, and instead of, you know, the 5-3-1 or West Side or whatever, so they can see the weight on the bar they like, they're doing things like, you know, just one set of 20 or one set of 14, and finding that athletes get just as strong, but they also jump higher, run faster when they do less. And it's an amazing thing, but just the idea of from the nervous system perspective, doing less. And I thought that was really interesting what you were mentioning, like just three reps on like the K-Box or something like that, being able to elicit what you're looking for.
Yeah, so you'll get your two warm-up or three warm-ups on the K-Box, and usually by your fourth rep, that's your best one. And then usually I shut them down. You'll see the numbers drop. But I think, you know, if you make the environment more difficult, it's even more effective then. So that's why I throw mats out when we're doing overspeed work, and sometimes you'll miss all the mats. You know, I can't guess perfectly every time. But to throw that, to make the athlete more anti-fragile by putting, you know, uneven heights on the road, or, you know, even when we're doing acceleration work, you know, stepping on and off something that's an inch high or a half inch high, or, oh my God, 2 inches high. You know, it makes them more anti-fragile and able to do the normal stuff better.
Yeah, I feel like kids get really just a kick out of, or very stimulated by, putting obstacles in the midst of an otherwise traditional workout set. And yeah. I've been playing with that a lot this last year, mostly based off of, you know, when you had first mentioned using the K-box and overspeed and obstacles. And that, I mean, that made me wish I was one of your athletes. I mean, that if you're a kid, it seems like there's nothing more fun than being towed and trying not to trip and trying to hit these mats.
Hit the mats.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I did, and I did it today for the first time, and I videotaped it. I just haven't figured out how I'm going to post it. But I took my mini hurdles, and I took a four-way PVC connector instead of a two-way, and I put it in between two hurdles, and then I put about a 12-inch pipe coming up out of the middle. And my idea was, when I have people run the line on the mini hurdles, they're always looking down, and you can still cheat through your hips and still hit on the right side of the line. So by putting this 12-inch stick up the middle, which, you know, the guys at first were a little worried and thought they had more than they actually had, and they were going to hit something. I completely, their running form became better than it normally would be just running through mini hurdles. The toe off position was much better, and it actually looked like they were using their hips more. And so they were, as Franz Bosch says, you know, whipping from the hip, but really getting their hips up high and running as tall as I've ever seen. And so, again, that was something that I was thinking, how am I going to make this drill better? How am I going to make them really challenge them on this drill that some of my athletes have been doing for years? And so I came up with this idea, and I found kids that have been going for a while, and I know would give me answers better than, yeah, it's okay. Yeah, I can't really feel it, but maybe I'll feel it later. And then I filmed it, and it was amazing, amazing.
Yeah, so you, yeah, for those, I know those who aren't familiar with your drill, you use wickets and a line, and if the athletes have to run on, you know, with their feet planting on either side of the line and not crossing over. And so, just to clarify, you were, so you had your wickets or your hurdles set up, and you put a PVC pipe that was almost like connecting the hurdles down the middle?
Yeah, so I took the two, I took a four-way joiner and stuck and broke two hurdles in half and just stuck the two ends together. And then out of one of the middle, out of the middle pipe going up, I put a 12-inch pipe coming through. I know I'm drawing pictures with my hands over Skype and nobody can see it, but so you could not, when you toe off or you're coming through the hurdles, you have to drive through your big toe and bring your hip up even higher than you normally would through the hurdles. I don't know what a wicket is, so I'm not calling it a wicket.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Yeah, I think that paints a little bit clearer picture. And yeah, definitely, it's, if I found anything too out of the using the hurdles, it's use them to do your coaching for you. It's,
yeah,
you do a lot better job than we do.
It's hard to screw up many hurdles. It's hard to go over them poorly if you know what to look for, which is a crossover. You want to get rid of that crossover gate.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it just working with youth track and field, like you see some. The prime examples of crossover is definitely working with the 10 to 12 year old population, and you hope to get rid of it before they get to, you know, high school and college.
Oh, it's brutal. Brutal. Yeah, you know, and I think, and I've told you before, if you can get that leg, if you can get the outside of your heel right underneath your hip, there's no way you can't run fast. You have to use your hips in that position, and your contact's going to be so much more underneath your hip. And so that's really a key. That's really a major key, I think.
Yeah, athletes find a lot of ways to plant outside and shut their power off through their hips, that's for sure.
They sure do. They sure do.
Yeah, so I'd like to chat with you, talking about kind of the mini hurdles and not looking down, and just vision in general. I know you've been doing a lot of work with vision. I think that's definitely something that's up and coming in, the performance field, but it's still a really young area. And I'd like to hear a little bit, or I think our listeners would like to hear a little bit about some things that you've been doing with vision and visual field work and the importance of the visual system in athletic development.
So I'm not an expert at it, so I'm probably going to get some stuff wrong, but here's kind of my journey. I forgot, it was probably Dan Fichter. Dan Fichter is always pushing stuff. But we started playing with color glasses. And I work with some neurochiros and some actual optometrists or ophthalmologists who are neuro-driven. So I run all this stuff by them, and we play. But we started with colored glasses, and they're expensive. They're $100 for the Roy G. Biv set. And normally red is your active color, but other people respond to different colors because there's qualities that people are looking for that the glasses can give you. So if you have a kid that's all hyped up and you put them in a pair of indigo glasses, it calms their system. But what we found is, and I've only found this with vertical jump, Dan has found it with bench press, because he does a lot of bench pressing stuff, that you can jack up people's numbers by changing the way they perceive the world through color. Different colors will get your nervous system to put out different things. And yes, that also means that you put the wrong color on a kid, they're not going to jump as high. So what we have found is, and this is really quite simple, is I went from going through and prescribing glasses to everyone and trying different colors. But what I have found was that if you let the kid pick the color, or the athlete pick the color, they usually pick the color that's going to make them go. And so we have these glasses out, and when you get stuck on a vertical jump, you put on the glasses and you jump. And we've seen people put on as much as 3 to 4 inches on a best vertical jump just by changing color. I'm not saying that's every time. I've seen it happen twice to get that high. But sometimes you'll get an inch or inch and a half out of a kid, and mentally that has huge impact for them to think, holy crap, I just put an inch and a half on my vertical jump. I was jumping 24, and now after 3 weeks I'm jumping 27. I want to keep training. And so you really drive that mental edge as well by giving kids that. I know how this started. One of the ladies I work with worked with the Blackhawks. She's got Stanley Cup rings and the whole thing. They were playing Columbus, and it was the first round of the playoffs last year. And the goalie, I don't know hockey very well, so I forget these guys' names. The goalie was getting shelled. And she started doing tests with him and realized that his shutdown color was yellow. Well, it was Columbus. Columbus is a yellow team. So anytime he'd look into the field, neurologically, he'd be shut down. His body would go into a weak mode. And so what she did is she trained him to his strength color with glasses, and then eventually got it to the point where they made a solid color. I can't remember what it was, but if you look on the back of his gloves, he's got electric tape in his strong color. And so if he saw a field of red, he would reset his visual field by looking down at the tape on his gloves. And then sure enough, that's when he went on that string where he shut out Columbus and then the next team. And I think it was so many games before anyone even scored a goal on him again. And so that's how we got interested in the colors, is with her work. And then from there, I've tried NeuroTracker, which is a 3D visual field game where you use your peripheral vision, because 90% of what you pick up is peripheral, and it actually can shut down your system if it's off. And now we have, I don't like them, but Dan likes them. They're glasses that have lights on one side, and you find your weak eye, and the lights kind of dance around the rim of the glasses of your of your weak side. And Dan's had some huge improvements in bench press messing with it. I'm just not very good at it, I guess. I'm not getting his kind of responses to the, I forgot what they're called, but the glasses with the lights on one side or the other. And then just, that's pretty much where we've went with that. And so remember, everything that you pick up is through vision, and your brain's going to respond to vision first. You're always going to defend yourself. And when you see something that scares you, or there's a part of your field that's shut down, you will shut down. And if you've done Be Activated with Douglas Heal and you've done the level two stuff, you know that there's places where you don't want to go visually, and you'll find ways to avoid it. And that if that happens to be straight ahead, you're going to be throwing your head all over the place. So even though you're telling the kid, hold your head still when you're running, maybe they're shut down in that field and they're trying to find strength by moving their head into a different position. So it creates this whole neurological challenge of, you know, what you're telling the kid, maybe they're doing it for a reason. Same thing with arms. You know, you can't tell your kids to hold their arms a certain way when they run, because really they're counterbalancing what's going on underneath. And if you tell them to change their arm pattern, you might be screwing up their gait and they're going to get hurt.
Yeah. Yeah, it all runs through the brain. And
it all runs through the brain.
That's the arms thing was something that I learned by reading some of that Franz Bosch material and torsion and you know, the ability of the core to direct movement, and if the arms are just the byproduct of everything else that's happening.
Yeah.
I really like how you mentioned it with the various vision things, and some of it does seem like it takes a little tinkering. You know, I just went to a Z Health seminar recently, and some of the drills it takes a lot of tinkering, you know, but when you get it, it can be really quite amazing. But
it's really powerful. This lady in Northbrook, another doctor, her name is Zielinski. She wrote a book, Ghost in the Brain, which is about this professor who got in a car accident, and he went, you know, he thought he was going to lose his mind with all the brain fog and everything, and through correcting his vision, she got rid of all that stuff. And so I've had a couple appointments with her, and it's powerful stuff, really powerful stuff, where she puts prism glasses on you and can change your gait just based on where you perceive the ground to be, which of course made me ask her, you know what, I have these sprinters and they kind of cross over, can you make me a set of glasses where they think that the ground is different and they've got to set their foot further outside, and then over time we'll gradually pull back the prism, and that way we're neurologically training that, you know, that wide step when you sprint, or that step that's even with your hip. And she told me this story about she already tried it.
Wow.
And the guy went on a jog and he got his foot caught in a grate for a sewer and he broke his ankle. And then after that, she said, I'm never doing this again. I'm not messing with this stuff anymore. I'm not going to. So I got to find another lady who'll do that for me.
Well, when you do, yeah. Yeah, they'll be the first product on your website. There is the gait correcting
prism glasses, which are really thick and really funky looking. But I'll tell you what, you know, she changed the way I moved just based on bending light, and whether I wanted to or not, that was how my body perceived the world to be, and I had to defend myself and protect myself, and she could do that.
Yeah, it's so interesting how the brain and our systems perceive what we're doing. You were mentioning too about the 1080, and it was such a crazy stimulus to the brain and vestibular systems or whatever that the athletes threw up, even though it wasn't aerobic work or lactate.
Yeah, they're in great shape. You know, we do workouts all the time, and all of a sudden we ran two flies, and it makes no sense. Yeah, and I think that's the disconnect, and not to knock on people, but you know, with the traditional old strength coaches, we're going to go into a bench, we're going to squat, and we're going to deadlift, and that's going to be the extent that we're going to challenge our nervous system, and we're going to do that for 8 months. You know, there's no challenge to the brain. You know, after you get it down, it's like, all right, what's next? Well, this isn't hard anymore. Okay, you're going to put more weight on. all right, to compensate, I'm going to have to change my posture, and maybe this isn't going to help me down the road.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest things that I've been, you know, my day job strength and conditioning that I've been really interested in or passionate about is just like, yeah, strength training works for everyone the first 7-8 weeks because you are learning for that first 7-8 weeks, but what happens after? You aren't, you know, you don't have any degrees of freedom and aren't learning anymore. And
yeah, your brain gets bored and it won't grow, you know, even though we think that there's this continual macro micro cycle of super compensation just because we want it to be that way and we've reduced it to a simple graph. I don't think that's the way it works. I think that there needs to be this constant simulation and challenge to how you're moving.
Yeah, it's and I think that's like one of the exciting things that's happening in the field right now that I think is going to unlock a lot of the creativity in coaches. Is just once you start to, you know, be able to utilize and just like how you were saying, you know, you made your own, you know, special mini hurdle to, you know, create this stimulus. And you know, I've had a lot of fun myself just kind of creating like bounding courses and with different colored cones and things like that. And it's like the sky's the limit with integrating all these systems and finding ways for athletes to learn in dynamic movement.
Because when it comes time to play, that's what's going to happen. There's a lot of stimulus that you have to react to. And I think that's why sometimes you get the kids that are great strength coach kids, you know, and I was one of them. I could do whatever the strength coach asked me to do. But then there was this disconnect when you got to the field and all of a sudden there wasn't, you know, there was all kinds of stimulus. And I'm used to saying, all right, put another 45 on and let's see if I can do it. And then all of a sudden all this stuff is going on. And I think that's another thing is we like to train comfortable and maybe we shouldn't. Maybe you should have bad music on when you're lifting weights and maybe you should have a strobe light going off or a flashing light going off. I got to do some stuff with some Navy SEALs and they talked about that, about how nothing is ever comfortable, that there's always crashes and bangs and sirens and explosions and stuff going off all the time. And that's what makes them concentrate on the task at hand. And you get used to that overstimulus and you're able to function when that time occurs.
Yeah, adapting to a high-powered, ever-changing environment. Yeah, it's athletics and military alike.
And it can be as simple as just tonal beeps. And this is kind of how I stumbled on this is, well, you've seen my driveway. I have a really long driveway. And I admit I get lazy and I drive my garbage out to the end of my driveway in my car. And so I've got the radio on. I've got my back door open. So I'm getting that beep going off. And then I have my normal beep going off that I'm backing up, and they're two different tones with two different frequencies. And I did it a couple of times, and at the end of my driveway, which is about 50 yards long, I was really frustrated and flustered. Like, why am I so angry at the end of this? And it's because I had these two different tones beeping at me and all the stimulus going on while I'm driving backwards, and my driveway bends, and you've got to bend around a tree. And I thought, that's it. It's all this stimulation that I'm not used to that, you know, maybe I challenge myself or my athletes with other stimulation to make this more difficult and make movement more difficult. I found that just by putting a strobe light on messes with people. If you really want to mess with something, play ping pong to a strobe light.
Yeah.
Make the frequency really hard and watch how people react. You have to guess where the ball is going, and you have to really it's a catching skill. You know, you have to guess trajectories on and off and recheck and refine ball. And so I do that sometimes with my children. We play strobe light ping pong. Not that I'm going to have some people show up at my house and pay me money to play ping pong with a strobe light, but try it sometime. Look, watch how difficult it is. Watch how it really challenges your hand-eye coordination, which is kind of important in sport, last time I checked.
Yeah, absolutely. Just wait till I have all the ping pong coaches in the world, or table tennis, I should say, knocking you know, knocking your door in to find the latest in technology. Cool. Well, hey, Chris, I think that's about all the time we have for today.
Okay.
Great stuff, man. I think there's so many things that coaches can use through all this.
Well, thank you for having me. It was nice to chat.
Absolutely. Well, we'll talk again soon. Thanks, Chris.
All right. Thanks for listening, guys. Again, if you want to check out Chris's DVDs, head on over to his website at slowguyspeedschool.com. Next time on the podcast, we will have Nick Garcia of Notre Dame High School and talking all things strength as well as Bonderchuk. It's going to be a great episode. I know you guys are going to love it. So stay tuned and have a good one.